I'm very happy now to welcome to the program author Courtney Martin and designer John Carey. They will be at the Santa Fe Art Institute tonight, actually at Tipton Hall at 6 o'clock at an event called Design Stories, Beginning, Middle, No End, and that's sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
So the two of you are coming to design, social change, activism from different perspectives. You, Courtney, are a feminist and an activist and a journalist, and you, John, are a designer, and your work has merged in very interesting ways. How did you come together? I mean, you wrote a beautiful article about kind of the conversation that started from your different perspectives.
Yeah, well, we joke that this is a love story in multiple ways. On the first level, it's a love story because we met and fell in love, and I'm, as you said, a journalist, and John is a designer, and prior to meeting him, I really knew nothing about design. I thought it was just for rich people, basically. I didn't really even understand what that word meant. And John kind of educated me about the ways in which design is sort of this invisible layer of everything we experience, from our built environments to the products we use to the systems that we have to deal with on a daily basis. And it really opened my eyes to realize that a lot of the work I had been writing about and thinking about in terms of social change was actually design stuff. Like, there were design problems that activists were trying to change. Well, for example, you know, a lot of the bureaucracies that particularly poor and marginalized people face, for example, if they're trying to access, you know, WIC or some kind of public assistance, they are burdened with these terribly designed processes to try to get the help they need, right? Or if you think about the tragedy of homelessness in this country and how many people can't get supportive housing because there are just endless steps that even someone with full mental faculties and, you know, access to support might have trouble getting through. We expect homeless folks to get through all of these steps. And so this new field of design activism is really looking at how do we reduce all of those steps so that people don't have the same redundancies and can kind of get through the system and get the help they need faster. So that's an example of redesigning a system. Obviously, there's other kinds of things.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not like visual design of being in a space.
Yeah, that's right. And while I'm trained as an architect, and the majority of my work to date had focused mostly on the built environment, on spaces and places, be they schools or community centers or health clinics and that kind of thing, I'm increasingly interested in these larger systems that Courtney referenced, as well as the design of products, things that we interact with on a daily basis, hold in our hands. And so while I apparently taught Courtney a little bit about design, she's taught me a lot about storytelling. And what I found is there's a ton of really well-intentioned designers out there in the world that want to make the world a better place. And yet their ability to interact with non-designers in terms of communicating the value of design is incredibly limited. And so what she really brought out for me is the value of storytelling. And it's storytelling to communicate the value of something, but it's also to communicate the impact that design has. Because a lot of times things are built and they're kind of, they become part of our lives, and we don't understand that they interrupted a social process or somebody's life in a positive way.
What are some examples of that, interrupting the social process?
So I think there's a great example of an apartment complex that we're very familiar with in San Francisco called the Richardson Apartments, and it's a partnership between Mercy Corps and Community Housing Partners of San Francisco. And they basically identified that it costs thousands of dollars to keep people on the streets every day. I mean, it costs a fortune to keep people on the streets, supporting them with services like emergency room care, police patrolling, that kind of thing. They ended up building this building that cost tens of millions of dollars, but over the long term will save a ton of money, meaning the people's cost of living and the city's support for them will decrease exponentially, to the point that it's on the order of about $1,000 a month is what they're using to support people that used to take about a few thousand dollars in city services almost a day, if not every week. And so, you know, that's an example of one such thing, I think.
And importantly, unlike sort of what people might be familiar with, sort of the history of public housing, for example, which has historically not been very beautiful.
Right.
One of the really cool things about this sort of new generation of the movement is that it's it's really convinced that everybody deserves good design, which means everybody deserves beauty and kind of a dignifying space. So these apartments that John is referencing are gorgeous. I mean, they're not fancy. They're very simple and they're small, but they really would give someone a sense when they walk into that apartment, like, I deserve this. I deserve a space that is beautifully designed, however simple or small it might be. And that's one of the things I've been most moved by as someone who cares about inequality and injustice, is that this design movement right now is really about that design can dignify, and that everyone deserves that sense of dignity.
In a housing project like that, are the apartments less likely to get trashed if they're beautiful?
It's possible. I mean, I'm not sure exactly how you'd measure that, but certainly there's a rapport between the residents and the staff, and the residents understand that they are there at the invitation of the staff and the organizations. And I think that they, in order to retain that standing with the organization, I think that there's some level of decorum that, you know, is expected. I think that when people have something, they understand that it's special, that they're more willing to maintain it. I'm sure there's incidents where that's not the case, but certainly on the whole, they've felt like these have been incredibly successful. So safety and also privacy is a huge aspect of this particular housing project. And they've created not just these private spaces, but also public spaces that themselves need to be maintained as well.
When you think, or when I think of beautiful design, I usually think of things that are out of my price range.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Beautiful furniture, beautiful houses, beautiful cars, whatever. And, you know, I'm perfectly happy with sort of threadbare middle class stuff. But you were talking about social change and activism and helping people kind of on the bottom end of the spectrum. So how does beautiful, I mean, you gave one example, but what are some other examples of how beautiful design fits into that?
Well, we're talking about design that dignifies and design that really makes people feel as special as we want every person to feel, obviously. We also want design to be really functional. And so there are literally hundreds of thousands of people in the world, especially in developing countries. In India, for example, there's 80,000 people with the need for prosthetic limbs. And yet prosthetic limbs, even in this country, cost thousands and thousands of dollars. And so one of the other projects that we're doing some work with is an organization called Design Revolution that is manufacturing a $13 prosthetic knee joint. And it's not a single hinge joint, so you know, like a door or a cupboard swings on a single hinge.
Right.
Well, that's not how our knee works either. It's not a single hinge. This is a multi-pivot point knee. And they're making it available to the poorest of the poor in India. They've already outfitted over 1,000 people with it. They have a goal to do another 1,000 people. And they want to get this into mass production for $13 a unit. And so that's just another example. And that's more on the function side. But nonetheless, even aesthetically, watching somebody walk with this multi-pivot point knee is so much more natural and familiar to us than watching somebody walk with the single joint knee.
You have also worked on revisioning cities. Is that correct?
Yeah. Both Courtney and I are have been involved with urban advocacy at different levels for a long time. But most recently, we became the co-leaders of the TED Prize, City 2.0, it's called.
What is that?
The City 2.0 is intended to be a vision for the future of cities globally. And it was launched by TED, which is this major enterprise that most people associate with these conferences that they put on annually, as well as these talks and lectures that they make available online through their website, TED.com.
Which are wonderful.
They are.
And both of you are on them, right?
Courtney's on them. I'm more of a behind-the-scenes kind of guy.
my
design works come through in some TED Talk PowerPoints, if that helps or counts for anything. But in the case of this this cities initiative that we're doing, we are trying to source or to extract or to pull out stories of everyday people and their experiences with their cities around the world. And so we've got some great examples that Courtney has either interviewed or that we're trying to get from a user-generated standpoint. And then in addition to the storytelling part of things, we have an initiative where we're giving micro-grants of $10,000 to help people launch projects to improve their cities all over the world. And so we have projects right now in Pakistan, in Rio, in tied with London in that case, in Australia, all over the world. And
actually there's a new deadline, August 15th, where it's the deadline for the next $10,000 prize. So if there are listeners who have an idea for a city project that they want to do, they can go to city2.org and apply for a project. So that's an opportunity for local folks here in Santa Fe.
What are some of the stories that you've gotten from your interviews about people interacting with cities?
I have so many favorites. This has been such a cool project. One of my favorites is that this guy in Adelaide, Australia, named Jason Sweeney, is doing a project where he's crowdsourcing quiet spaces in cities. He's creating this platform.
That sounds so much like an oxymoron.
I know, doesn't it? It's amazing. It's so layered. It's such an interesting project. He himself is the kind of person who gets really overwhelmed by noise, but has lived in big cities all his life because he's an artist and he loves big cities. And he realized that people in cities kind of figure out these little spaces, right? Particularly in Santa Fe, I think you can find a lot of them where there's a little bit more peace and quiet, which is funny as we're in this cafe with all this wonderful noise to talk about. But so Jason's basically created this platform where he's going to get people all over the world to identify spaces in their cities where someone who needs a little reprieve can go and kind of take a deep breath. And the implications...
No one's going to do that because then their little secret will be given away.
Well, that's the big question with this project is, will the social contract be in place such that people really do respect that this is a quiet place for someone?
I wouldn't put... If I had a space like that, I wouldn't tell anybody.
You keep it secret. The more serious implications of this project, which I think are really important, are just that a lot of folks with disabilities find cities very overwhelming and tend to get into a moment in a big urban, you know, busy environment where they literally could have a seizure or, you know, have some mental health problems. And so, you know, there's the layer of just those of us who are introverts and need some place to kind of rest our head, but also the idea that disabled people would have a chance through this crowdsourced map to find a quiet space and kind of recover if they're in a place where they need to do that. So, I mean, it's just really creative stuff like that. We also have more sort of straightforward projects. There's a guy in Pakistan who's mapping the water in his village in order to try to prevent cholera infection through contaminated water. You know, so there's some things that would be more kind of run-of-the-mill to anyone who pays attention to global health, but there's also some pretty creative stuff going on, too.
We're talking to Courtney Martin and John Carey, who are going to be speaking tonight at Tipton Hall. It's called Design Stories, Beginning, Middle, No End. And so you'll be basically telling some of these stories.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
You're telling us now.
Yeah, we want to share these stories, and we want to really give people in the audience, both those who do have a design background, we hope they'll walk away feeling like they're a little bit more equipped to think about the value of storytelling and the value of speaking with non-designers, because designers tend to be a pretty clubby crowd. They like to talk to each other about design, and we're really trying to break that up. And then we also hope non-designers will come who just want to understand design a little better, want to have some way of kind of figuring out how it affects their lives or the lives of the people they work with.
Yeah, there's so many examples in all of our lives. Like, I put a flagstone path through the yard, mm-hmm. and it really changes the experience of being outside.
Yeah.
And you can also imagine people working in social service agencies or public agencies where we all know that those are some of the least inspiring environments.
Yeah.
We want them to think differently and to realize that they deserve good design.
Taking a wrecking ball and starting over?
I mean improving the spaces in which they're spending a huge percentage of their lives, certainly their work lives. I've worked with a lot of folks in the social sector, so in the nonprofit sector, that kind of wear their shabby offices and their flimsy business cards and their, you know, non-existent letterhead as badges of honor. And I actually think that we need to totally move away from that to the point that people go into these spaces, meaning funders, volunteers, donors, but especially patients, clients, and that kind of thing, and expect that they be comfortable spaces of healing, because in most cases they're not. And we really think that there's, you know, a huge opportunity for those kind of spaces to be improved.
Our Rape Crisis Center, when they built a new space here in Santa Fe, made this beautiful, colorful, lovely space, and they did that exactly for those reasons.
So. Yeah, and there's scientific research in environmental psychology is the name of the field that shows that it really does affect people. I mean, it changes their capacity to do that kind of difficult work that goes on in a rape crisis center. It changes their capacity to sustain that kind of work. I mean, a lot of burnout can be directly related, not just to, like, the mental health difficulties of the work people do, but also just the environments in which they're forced forced to do it. And I think, you know, we've all had experiences of that. I certainly in the feminist world have seen, you know, many a women's center like in the basement with no light and like no breathable air. And, you know, I'd always sort of cast that off as just like one of those things that if I was going to be an activist, I had to be okay with that. And being exposed to this work that John and his colleagues in the movement are doing has really forced me to reconsider that, you know, as long as women or anybody who's been sort of traditionally oppressed continue to accept spaces that don't make them healthy, we're kind of, you know, buying into the fallacy that we're fighting against in the first place.
Well, I think the other opposite psychology is sort of operative, which is we don't want to become like the oppressor, so we're never going to get into nice, fancy, beautiful spaces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and I think fancy is the operative word there, right? Because one of the things I've really learned from being exposed to this is really not about fancy. You know, like, it's really, like the example of the prosthetic knee, it's actually about something, it's a much deeper definition of beauty. It's not beauty in the sense of sort of traditionally beautiful
ornamentation,
you know, ornamentation or Hollywood versions of what beauty is. It's about beauty as human beings getting to live their very best lives. So if that's a prosthetic knee that actually works and makes someone feel dignified when they put it on, or whether that's, you know, a beautiful building that's going to house a suicide hotline where people are doing really hard work and need to have bright colors and light and ventilation, like, you know, we're really arguing for a very kind of comprehensive and holistic idea of beauty, not, you know, the fancy Manhattan East Side version of beauty.
I think we're also arguing for what Courtney's kind of termed design literacy, where people know how to both identify design that either makes them uncomfortable or makes them comfortable, as well as, you know, really demand it and call for it and ask for it. And I think that that's another huge aspect of this.
One of our favorite stories is from, there's a project in New York City where the Robin Hood Foundation, which is just a fantastic organization helping get people out of poverty, and some a whole combination of designers and manufacturers, et cetera, work together to redo school libraries in public schools. 56 of them in New York City. And they're just gorgeous when you see these pictures. They're bright and imaginative and funny and creative. And you know, John tells the story of how one of the designers told him that this little boy came to school to see his school library for the first time redesigned, and he was just amazed. And he came back the next day with a little suitcase because he decided he wanted to move into the library.
Aww.
And I feel like that's the kind of thing where, you know, like, that experience is going to change that kid's life forever. I mean, we all know the power of books, but, you know, a bunch of books sitting in a dingy room that no one wants to go into is power unused, you know? So here's this little boy who's actually going to feel at home in a place of learning. And that, to us, is just those are the defining moments of this kind of design work.
Mm-hmm. So you will be talking tonight and showing images of your work, and then in a week, on Monday, the 13th of August, in the evening, you, Courtney, are going to be doing a workshop called Feminism in the New Media Landscape. What's that all about?
Yeah, so I'm going to hopefully help folks who don't know much about it and also give some advanced learning for those who do know something about it in terms of what's happening in online feminism. So, you know, the feminist movement is seeing its third or fourth wave, arguably, and a lot of that is actually going on online. And I've had so many interesting interactions with older women who say, "Where are all the young feminists?" And I say, "Okay, you got to log onto your computer and go to this website," because they're really not marching in the streets in the same way, you know, mothers and grandmothers did. But they're online doing a lot of interesting activism. We saw some of that recently with Rush Limbaugh when he called Sandra Fluke a slut, and there was this huge online movement to get his advertisers pulled. We saw it with the Planned Parenthood when the Komen Foundation was going to pull funding from Planned Parenthood, and there was this huge kind of uprising online to substitute that funding for Planned Parenthood. So there's just some really interesting stuff going on online, and I want to talk about that, clue people into where it is, sort of give a new map for the feminist movement.
What are the concerns of the feminist movement among people in your generation, 20s and early 30s, for example?
I think that, you know, there's no monolithic concern. That's part of what makes it so difficult, is that there's no super cohesive movement anymore. It's pretty decentralized, but I think that's actually an asset in many ways. I think, you know, racism, sexism, classism, all these things matter to feminists these days. And again, that makes it harder because there's not one issue that we can all rally around, but it also makes it a really rich kind of landscape where we're concerned about a lot of things. I mean, certainly people are concerned about their basic reproductive rights and things that we've traditionally associated with feminism. But I also see feminists being worried about immigration reform and things that you might not necessarily say, oh, that's a feminist issue.
How is immigration reform a feminist issue?
Because the majority of people who end up suffering our totally broken immigration system are women and children. And that's, you know, those are the most vulnerable populations in our world right now, on every scale. I mean, even if you look at like environmental justice, it's women and people of color, women and children who are most affected by climate change. So you kind of take any of these issues and you look at who's the most vulnerable population, and it turns out feminists have to care about it because it's really, you know, again, women and children, vulnerable populations who are most susceptible to those things.
So the two of you are doing a residency at the Santa Fe Art Institute for pretty much the whole month of August. What are you working on?
So we're here with this amazing group of artists from around the world, and we're here wrapping up this major exhibition that we're staging in San Francisco with about a dozen projects that represent design and social change, and have a huge design storytelling component associated with them. That exhibition will open October 4th at the Autodesk Gallery in San Francisco, so we're really excited about that.
Courtney Martin is an author, and John Carey is a designer, and your websites are CourtneyMartin.com and JohnCarey.com, is that correct?
.us.
.us. It's, and Carey is spelled C-A-R-Y.
Yes.
And they will be, once again, at Tipton Hall tonight at 6 o'clock, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.